Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This week, Groundwire is produced at CFRU in Guelph, Ontario. I'm Candace Jahani.
I'm Steve Mason.
What this report reveals may shock some British Columbians, and hopefully it will prompt some change.
There were 200 RCMP officers from multiple provinces coming in.
They're already being paid an average of $3 a day because they're already factoring in room and board. Now they're coming in and saying, oh, well, it's time to take out room and board.
A small group of Anishinaabe people are entering the seventh month of their occupation of Springwater Provincial Park, 10 kilometers outside of Barrie, Ontario. Elizabeth Brass Elson, one of the occupiers, asserts that she is exercising her right based on Article 26 of the United Nations Declaration of Indigenous Peoples, having the right to land and resources that were once traditionally occupied, and that, as an Anishinaabe woman, Elson says, it is her duty to protect the water from harm. The province maintains that the park's $60,000 annual budget is an untenable drain on its already strapped coffers, but Ken Lacroix of Parks Ontario has attempted to allay fears of the park being sold to private developers by proposing that the province is only interested in business proposals from potential partners to open the park for the 2014 operating season. If Elson is successful, this will be her third major victory, having been a major part of the protests that closed Dump Site 41 and Mega Quarry. For now, Elson and the province remain in a stalemate. But Les Stewart contends that if the ministry is playing a game of delaying hoping the freezing temperatures and lack of snow will force Elson off, they've really chosen the wrong activist.
The British Columbia Representative for Children and Youth released a report indicating that the child welfare system is wasting millions of dollars and failing Aboriginal children. CJSF's Frieda Worden has this headline from Burnaby.
Mary Ellen Terpel Lafond is a member of the Muskeg Cree Nation in Manitoba. She grew up on reserve. At age 35, she became appointed as a provincial judge in Saskatchewan. Since 2006, she has been on leave from the court, serving as British Columbia's first official representative for children and youth. Hers is an independent office of the Legislative Assembly of British Columbia, not under the Ministry of Child and Family Development. This gives her freedom to criticize the ministry, and on Wednesday, November 6, 2013, she exercised that freedom.
What this report reveals may shock some British Columbians, and hopefully it will prompt some change in how MCFD and the provincial government as a whole approaches the difficult job of serving this vulnerable sector of our population. The report shows that MCFD between 2002 and today has spent more than $66 million on Aboriginal service delivery change and really the quest to find someone else to serve this population.
Mary Ellen Terpel Lafond, BC's official representative for children and youth, at a press conference in Victoria. For Groundwire, I'm Frieda Worden.
Professor and activist Noam Chomsky was in Montreal in October to give a series of sold-out lectures. CKUT's Aaron Lakoff has this headline from Montreal.
Professor Noam Chomsky gave his first public lectures in Montreal in over a decade in October to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Winnipeg-based grassroots magazine Canadian Dimension. The 85-year-old linguist, writer, and political theorist gave a series of speaking events at Concordia, UQAM, and the University of Montreal to packed houses. During the question and answer period at the University of Montreal, Chomsky was asked about the Quebec Charter of Values and unequivocally denounced it.
The Charter of Values, well, again, you know more about this than I do, but I presume that's somewhat influenced by the French passion, what they call secularism, which is simply banning expressions of dress, any independent expressions of one's own culture. And that's supposed to be anti-French. And in fact, Europe altogether, in my opinion, is much more racist than the United States. I mean, it hasn't shown very much because the societies are homogeneous enough so that it's not so visible. But as soon as there's any break in the homogeneity, you see it very quickly. In fact, what's happening in France right now is absolutely shocking, both because of what's happening and the lack of comment, namely what's happening to the Roma, called the Gypsies. Now, the Roma are Holocaust victims. Now, they were treated pretty much like the Jews under the Holocaust. and the French government is forcibly expelling them back to repression, violence, terror in Eastern Europe. I mean, if they were doing that to the Jewish community, that'd be, I mean, you can't even imagine the horrors that would be expressed. It did hit the newspapers a couple of days ago. You saw it, I'm sure, when the French police pulled a Roma girl, a 15-year-old girl, off a school bus and sent her off to be deported. That kind of raised some eyebrows. I really hesitate to talk about it because you know more than I do, but my impression from down south is that what's going on in Quebec is a little bit like that, trying to impose a kind of cultural uniformity of a sort that I think ought to be resisted. People should be free to...
The Quebec Values Charter was introduced into the Quebec legislature on November 7th, but is yet to be submitted to a vote. The controversial piece of legislation proposes to ban the wearing of religious symbols such as hijabs and kippahs in public offices, hospitals, and schools. Recently, the Montreal Jewish General Hospital vowed to defy the charter if it becomes law. For Groundwire, this is Aaron Lakoff for CKUT Radio in Montreal.
Now it's time for our feature stories.
On November 14th, LCBOOK took residents and supporters protested Southwestern Energy's attempt to continue seismic testing in the area. Jaggi Singh interviewed Amanda Lickers on No One is Illegal Radio, CKUT, on November 7th about the ongoing police repression.
Amanda is a member of the Turtle Clan of the Seneca Nation of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy.
By virtue of laying down this incredible raid where literally there were 200 RCMP officers from multiple provinces coming in, and there was maybe 30 or 40 people at the camp at the time, and there were no weapons on the site, and they come in with long rifles, and there were snipers in the grass. I mean, some of these people had 6, 7, 8 like sniper scopes on them at any given time. They did this in order for SWN to have their equipment removed so they can resume seismic testing. And this is actually aiding the violation of not only treaties between the Mi'kmaq people and the settlers here, but it's also a violation of the Canadian Constitution, where the Crown is obliged to undergo meaningful consultation with Indigenous peoples and Indigenous nations before resource extractive projects ensue. And so the role of the RCMP has been to protect SWN and to enforce the violation of treaties and to allow a total corporate free-for-all on unceded territory, as well as with some of the intelligence that's coming to the camp now. We've seen that the RCMP have a very strong presence wherever SWN is suspected of being, and in some cases even shutting down the highway to ensure that SWN can try to resume testing without interference. And so their role has been to protect the interests of the Canadian state and maintain and squash this resistance against colonialism, as well as to protect this corporation and their process of resource extraction.
Resistance to fracking in LCBOOK took continues. Meanwhile, three Mi'kmaq warriors remain in custody awaiting trial. On Friday, November 8th, Aaron Francis, Jermaine Jr. Bro, and Cody Stevens pleaded not guilty. Amanda Lickers interviewed David Mazarol, who was recently released. Watch the video on ReclaimTurtleIsland.com.
My name is David Mazarol. I'm one of the six shale gas demonstrators, and I'm with the Mi'kmaq Warrior Society. I'm 19 years old, and I was one of the 40 people that got arrested, but I was one of the six that got left in there also. And after that brutal force, the way they treated us in the Moncton drunk tank wasn't right, because they left us in there with no blanket, no bed, until like 5:30 in the morning, and they wouldn't give us toilet paper.
And then what happened when you were moved to the Southeast Correctional Center?
Well, after we got split up and put in solitary confinement, my buddy Aaron, as he was getting transferred, got beat up while he was in handcuffs. And they wouldn't give him no toothpaste, they wouldn't give him a toothbrush, They cut us all off completely of the phones. They said we could talk to our lawyers, but none of us got to talk to them until 2 days before me and Jason got out. And, like, they didn't... Usually when you get put in jail, you're 2 weeks on a closed program, but they didn't even... And those people usually get a half-hour break every day, and they get to use the phone and whatever, but we didn't even get any breaks. We were just constantly in that hole until we went to court. Come back, you're back in the hole. And I just want my warriors that are in there to have some humane treatment at least, because I'm pretty sure they're still getting treated like that.
And have you heard from anyone who's in jail?
No, because they're not allowed to call out.
And do you have a message for people who want to support you?
Help the warriors that are still in there, because they ain't getting treated right.
You just heard Dancing with the Branches by Jordan Raycroft, a Canadian singer-songwriter with a unique blend of contemporary folk.
And now Dee from Prison Radio CKUT brings us updates on prisoner resistance to the 30% pay deductions that went into effect at the beginning of October.
Federal prisoners went on a work strike in early October in various federal prisons across Canada. Prison authorities quickly suppressed the majority of these strike initiatives by either placing prisoners that they deemed the leaders in the hole and or transferring them out to different prisons. Jackie Nicholson is a member of the Prisoners Strike Support Network, an ad hoc group formed in solidarity with the federal prisoners' strike.
There's a little bit of a scale in federal prisons, ranging from $1 a day, and that's a day, not an hour, up to about $6.90 a day, which was the highest level of pay that a federal prisoner could receive prior to these wage cuts. They're already being paid an average of $3 a day because they're already factoring in room and board. Now they're coming in and saying, oh, well, it's time to take out room and board. But they've been paying room and board for 32 years and with no cost of living increase. Those rates were set back in 1981, and they have not changed since.
So let's talk about the prisoner work strike at Stony Mountain. It lasted for a long time.
So Stony was actually, my understanding is they were a little bit later to start striking. A lot of the federal prisons went out right on October 1st, the day that the cuts were to take effect, and they had planned this for some time. I feel like my anecdotal reportings from people I've been talking to in Stony say that Stony took about a week longer to start, but then they actually held out about a week or even more longer than everybody else, right up until about, I think November 1st was the first day that they went back to work. So at this point, a lot of the other federal penitentiaries had gone back to work, the reason being that they've all retained the same lawyer. I forget the fellow's name, someone out of Ottawa, and I guess the strategy that they're sort of collaborating on is that they're going to go into negotiations with Corrections Canada to attempt to get these wage cuts rolled back. And they're going back to work as sort of a show of good faith so that, you know, they can show that, you know, we are willing to work, but we need you to listen to us. So I guess the idea is they're going back to work for now, but they do have a strike mandate to go back out on strike again on November 20th if the negotiations don't go the way that they want.
On Friday, November 1st, a conference on the issue of Ontario's minimum wage took place at the Delta Hotel Conference Center in Guelph. CFRU spoke with Janice Folk Dawson, president of QP Local 1334, and a staunch advocate of the $14 minimum wage.
This is a really important day for members of the Guelph community and for members, for people living in Ontario. I think it's really important that we are, as communities, discussing the fact that we have many members in our communities who are living below the poverty line making minimum wage. And this is our opportunity to speak out about that and to try to influence the government that there needs to be some changes. They need to pay attention to the issue of poverty, and one of the ways to address the issue of poverty in this province is to look at what's happening with the minimum wage. And in fact, when minimum wage is raised, when those lowest earners in our community now have some purchasing power back, where there's some confidence in the economy, the results have been that we've seen the creation of jobs.
Terry O'Connor, the first vice president at the Guelph and District Labor Committee, feels much the same.
What do you think of the current state of the minimum wage in Ontario?
Well, clearly the evidence shows that the minimum wage needs to go up. It's been frozen now for a couple of years. It is something that is directly related to poverty.
And here, something we've been hearing in the panel is, I think we hear two spectrums. People that say $14 is not enough, and people that say, oh, that will lead to unemployment and there won't be tons of people without jobs because businesses won't be able to finance an increase in the minimum wage.
Right.
So what do you say to those folks? Like, people have said that just now.
Okay, so the minimum wage, we know, does not cover the basic necessities of life. What we do know is that the living wage, which for Guelph is $15.95 an hour, does cover those basic necessities. So my position, personally, would be to eliminate minimum wage altogether and the government promote and work towards providing living wage for people in Ontario.
We found Patrick O'Brien in the audience and asked him what he thought.
What are you doing here, and what do you think of what you've heard today?
Well, me and some friends came over to protest and make our voices heard because we think it's obvious that the minimum wage should be increased at least to $14. That's just a start, because people just can't live with the minimum wage right now. And well, we've heard a lot of good arguments in favor of increasing the minimum wage, and how I think the main point is the money's out there. It's just that employers are keeping it in their pockets or their bank accounts or in tax havens. So it's just a question of redistributing the money to the people that need it. And yeah.
The Chamber of Commerce and the National Coalition of Convenience Store Owners stand opposed to an increase in the minimum wage, claiming that it will cause a spike in the unemployment rate and, in fact, not work to decrease poverty overall. I'm Thomas Keith, and you're listening to Radio CFRU 93.3 in Guelph.
Brock University students have recently voted to defund CFBU-FM, their campus radio station. CFBU has over 100 volunteers and has been on the air since 1998. The campaign to defund CFBU was initiated when a student representative was not ratified at this year's annual general meeting. Led by BUSAC counselors, the initiative to defund the station was achieved on October 31st, and CFBU will continue to receive funding until winter of 2014. The station will continue to broadcast and provide programming for the community.
Last year, we actually did have a referendum, and it wasn't really a campaign to remove funding. It was the student union reassessing all the ancillary fees. So they started rolling through the various ancillary fees and more or less said, you know, no student has come forward in the past, you know, X number of years to question these fees. so we're going to do it for you. And so they started rolling through and putting various ones up for referendum to see if students wanted to continue to fund those. So our referendum was last year. We did pass that referendum. And so this one was a bit of a surprise for us, I have to say. The only reason it came about was because in July, we had an annual general meeting. And at that annual general meeting, the student union executive, so on our board, we have a student council representative as well as one of the four student union executives. And the person that they sent over to us as the delegate did not get ratified at the AGM, and so Brock Radio asked for another delegate, and we were not sent one. In the meantime, we elected a BUSAC representative to sit on the board, and that BUSAC representative came to the first board training session in August. So even before the board had an opportunity to actually meet as a board, they have a full-day board training workshop so they can get together and start working as a team and get some of the history and all of that. And basically, she walked out of that after about an hour and a half because she was upset that we hadn't elected the other person. So then she went off and launched a quote-unquote student-led petition and got enough signatures to launch another referendum to defund the radio station.
Into the desert.
Crockard, who is a programmer here at CFRU and who used to be a programmer at CKMS, the radio station that used to be based at the University of Waterloo in Waterloo, Ontario.
I was there at the time the defunding happened. The unsettling aspect of that really caused a big ripple through the listenership, I believe, as well as the membership there.
How do you think the perception of that programming that they are able to create has changed?
There was an attempt at the time of the defunding, and actually they had begun it just before, I think as an attempt to rebrand the station. That was at the time that they adopted the Sound FM moniker. I mean, the call letters are still CKMS. It's a matter of their mandate and licensing. They still carry that label, if you will. But their attempt at rebranding it was to take it into the community and to make it more, I guess, hip, student-friendly, perhaps. The vote wasn't as close as they'd hoped, and that branding failed on that level. And to be honest, I'm not sure how that has worked in terms of its presence in the community.
It sounds like that would really affect the access to the airwaves.
Yeah, where you have to either become an advertising exec on a very small scale yourself and sell time on your own program to finance that, or just fund it yourself.
With CFBU and St. Catharines losing its student funding, how do you think that would affect the campus and the community?
It would be a tragedy to have them removed from the airwaves if that becomes the case, or if they struggle and have problems with funding and their programming becomes less vital. That would be a true tragedy, I believe.
All of us at CFRU in Guelph wish the best to CFBU at Brock University. We look forward to more CFBU-produced radio content from St. Catharines and beyond. CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph's campus and community radio station, has had a pretty amazing year in 2013. We are thankful for the great relationships we have on our University of Guelph campus, throughout Guelph, and with our neighboring cities. In the last year, CFRU has had an array of new programs. We have had 26 new programs in the last year alone and continue to build relationships for syndicated programs. We've had 26 original spoken word programs, programming in 6 languages, daily programming from 7 a.m. to midnight and sometimes well beyond, 99 weekly non-BBC programs, 117.5 hours of original programming weekly, and an astounding over 6,000 hours of original radio in the last year.
This week by Candice Jahani, Gabriel Enni, Steve Mason, and myself, Thomas McManus. Special thanks goes out this week to Carly Forbes at CILU, who produced not one but two of our feature pieces. Headlines this week by Frida Werden, Aaron Lakoff, our very own Gabriel Enni, and me, Thomas Keith McManus. Music this week by Jordan Raycroft, Y Oak, and Ryan Hemsworth featuring Bats.
Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station, or download at groundwire.ncra.ca.
Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.